It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, to remind you, as you hear conversation and topics, don't hesitate to give them a call to expand upon the information you're hearing today, or possibly to get new topics and discuss new issues. That number, by the way, is 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And you can go online to learn more about the firm and make contact with them digitally at harvellandcollins.com. That's Harvell and, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, good afternoon. Wes, good afternoon to you as well.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
All right. The topic today is what?
Lockwood, we're going to let Mr. Collins kind of lead us through the program today relative to some of the, if you will, ins and outs and suggestions that might exist in the world of construction. We have quite a bit of construction litigation or conflict that somehow evolves in the construction arena. There's a lot of development, of course, in Eastern North Carolina, right, and we're involved in that. There's nothing worse than building a home or buying a lot and wanting to do certain kinds of improvements to it and then running into construction issues with various contractors and subcontractors, things of that nature. So, Wes, you have quite a few of those cases, don't you?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. You know, it kind of ebbs and flows, Lockwood, with construction-related issues. Very busy right now. Obviously, I think over the past year or two, interest rates were low. They're mm-hmm. not so low right now, and I think that, along with the, the people figuring out that they could work from home and, right, and moving to this area, I think that there was just has been and still is a huge boom in construction. You know, not to mention all of the construction that took place in reconstructing things after Hurricane Florence. A lot of that was done maybe quickly and maybe not in the best quality. You know, some of that obviously was done great, but some was done, you know, very, very quickly because many reasons. It was hard to get contractors,
right,
one reason, hard to get subcontractors. It was, the market was just flooded as far as the need went. So I would say right now, and I've certainly seen this before multiple times in my years of practice, but I would say right now is a pretty high time as it relates to construction-related issues. So, you know, we represent general contractors. We represent owners. So we're on both sides of the fence. Sometimes we represent subcontractors, depending mm-hmm. on the circumstance. But most folks understand how that works. You know, you have normally a general contractor who is the person who pulls the permits and has to have the license as a general contractor and is licensed in the state and is the individual, usually through a company, who is responsible for making sure that, number one, everything is constructed, everything that's done is constructed to the North Carolina Building Code, and number two, that everything is constructed to a workmanlike standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's people, you know, kind of think that the warranty with regard to work that's done on a particular piece of property is a 1-year warranty. That's what you kind of hear on the street. 1-year warranty, 1-year warranty. Well, that's true that general contractors normally expressly communicate that they'll provide a 1-year warranty for any of their work. And kind of what that's about is that if anything pops up during the first year, they'll come and fix it. Because, you know, when you have construction done, sometimes things settle, paint dries more, caulk, you know, dries more, things show up during that first year that might need a little bit of sprucing up. And contractors, you know, normally are going to come back and handle those type things. But the reality is if you have you know, it doesn't even have to be a significant issue, but normally if you have a significant problem, like it, let's say that you have, you know, a leak that you find out where water has been leaking into your walls, you've got a mold issue.
Right.
Or you've got, you know, some foundation issue, mm-hmm. or you've got something that comes up. Normally, in that situation, it's important for folks to know that they have 3 years from the date that they learn of whatever that situation is. The first time there's any type of indication that there's a problem, they would have 3 years to, you know, basically bring a lawsuit relative to that problem. So it's not just the 1 year warranty that is normally, you know, kind of verbally extended. It may be part of a contract as well, a written contract, but it's also the 3 year statute of limitations for the breach of the contract, the breach of the work that was done, as far as when you first learned of a problem. So people should note that. I mean, even if you're in a situation where your contractor knows about the problem, they say they're going to deal with it, you know, you still need to be careful not to wait past that three-year period of time, because if you do, you may not have any rights at all to deal with that issue.
Okay, so I want to clarify this. If I discover now a year or two after the construction has done that there was a failure in, say, the plumbing, and it's an indication that it was poorly installed, from that moment I have, and that's 2 years after I after I've been in the house, I've got 3 years in which to initiate some action. Am I correct on that?
That is correct.
Okay.
And since you brought up plumbing, let me give you a scenario mm-hmm. where, you know, sometimes things end up being a bigger deal than you think.
Right.
Let's say that you have a house built, and let's say that you just noticed for a year or two that there's just, you know, in some of the rooms in the house, there's just a smell.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know if it's because of an insulation issue, if you don't know if it's because of a mold, something going on. You have someone come in and they determine that the plumbing was done improperly, and the reason you have the smell is because the plumbing wasn't properly vented
right
out of the top of the house. Well, okay, that seems like that's not that big of a deal, but in order to get to mm-hmm. the plumbing, in order to properly install the venting, walls have to be opened up,
right?
Counters tops have to be torn out. You know, things have to be really, as I say, undone and redone, so it becomes a much bigger deal.
Uh-huh.
So that, I mean, you know, you've got to really pay attention to what's going on in your home. So if there are things like that going on, you know, you get someone to look at it and figure out what the problem is, because if you learn about it or really deal with it too late, then you may not be able to do anything about it. So now back to your question, yes, you've been in the home for a year or two, you recognize or learn that there's a problem, the plumbing, whatever it may be. You have 3 years from the date that you learn of that to bring a lawsuit. Now, however, that three-year period of time cannot extend beyond the six-year statute of repose from the date that the certificate of occupancy was issued. So that's another statute we have to be concerned with.
Okay, so if I understand that correctly, basically it's a six-year window, and let's say I'm in the house for 7 years and I suddenly come to the conclusion that there's an error in construction, some problem. However, I've been in the house for 6 years, so I don't have that option then for looking for recourse. Am I correct on that?
That's correct, and
okay.
It's not really based on how long you're in the house. It's based on substantial completion.
Okay.
And substantial completion Ooh. Is defined by the issuance of the CO, which is the Certificate of Occupancy.
Okay.
Yep. So, you know, just folks just need to recognize that, you know, if you've got an issue with your property and you've known about it and you think that, maybe you've been talking with your contractor about it, and they're going to fix it, and it just doesn't get done and doesn't get done and doesn't get done. Pay attention to how long you've known about it, because the 3 years is the 3 years. It's from the date that you knew or should have known of it. That's the first one. And then the second one is the 6 years from the certificate of occupancy.
Okay, I'm going to bring up something here before we take a quick break. And we're talking with, in this case, Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And we're talking about construction contracts and the whole issue associated with construction disputes. You know, Cecil, one of the things that I know that, as you say, as a lawyer, often document, document, document. What process should we go through in those instances where we suddenly discover or where we think we have determined a problem? How do we, should we reach out to a third party and say, come in and document this so that, it, if you will, it gives us justification for any kind of action?
Well, Lockwood, right out of the gate, let's just say to our listeners, you need to put your agreement between your your worker and yourself in writing.
Okay.
Okay. It, you know, you need to reduce it to writing. Sometimes we're just, you know, redoing, you know, the porch or redoing a window or something small, and we just don't think it's necessary to reduce something like that to writing, but it is. And then of course, when you move into foundation to roof construction, beginning to end, absolutely those contracts need to be reduced to writing. And it's not a bad idea to have someone like Wes review them. There are provisions in the contracts that I know that Wes likes to see. For instance, you know, mediation, arbitration, attorney fees, awarding of attorney fees.
Okay.
All of these things are not automatic in the state of North Carolina. Let me let Wes pick up on some of this, but there are some very pro provisions that I'm sure that Wes would love to see in a contract. And so Wes, talk to us a little bit about that.
All right. Before Wes does, I just want to remind folks, we're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Cecil just a moment ago, of Harvell and Collins. And I want to remind you, as we're hearing a moment ago, it's very easy for us to reach out to Harvell and Collins just to do a review of something of, well, simple as a construction contract. And it's very interesting. Back to you, Wes. What do you want to see in those contracts and those written agreements? Because I mentioned a moment ago, document, document, document. What kind of documents are you looking for?
Well, Lockwood, my goodness, I have seen all kind of construction contracts. And normally when I see them, there's a problem. They're normally brought to me after there's an issue.
Right.
And then I'm looking at them and I'm trying to figure out what in the heck these people really agreed to.
Uh-huh.
So let's just start with, yes, if I'm in a position, if I'm lucky enough for a client to be in a position to be reviewing the contract before they've signed it, then I'm going to want to see a lot of clarity as to exactly what the parties have agreed to. Now, it's hard to get, you know, a lot of clarity, but a lot of clarity in a construction contract with words alone. So in many cases, I'm wanting to incorporate into the contract the plans. I'm wanting to see those plans and make them an Exhibit A so that we have something to go from. You know, it's just hard to describe with the English language with words exactly what's being constructed without having it out on a, you know, plans on a schematic. So plans are important, details are important. Regarding specific provisions, you know, perhaps an arbitration clause, that means that we don't go to court, we arbitrate the matter. That sometimes can save some money. It can avoid the possibility of an appeal. It can fast-track a resolution, those type things. I want to be very specific with regard to the compensation procedure and process and timing. Is this a cost plus? You know, how are we... how are we calculating the cost so we determine what the plus is and what cost plus is basically, you know, if you you basically pay a percentage of the total cost of the project. If the project costs $100,000 and the percentage is 18%, you're going to have an $18,000 contractor fee, you know, cost plus. If it's a flat fee, then I want to know what's included in that flat fee. I want to, you know, because you have to be careful with a flat fee contract, because once you agree on that number, it's kind of on both sides. There's a built-in incentive for the general contractor. I'm not saying that every general contractor is going to do this, but if you have a flat fee for the work that's going to be done, you have to know exactly what the work is. Mm-hmm. And it has to be spelled out, and there's a built-in financial incentive in the contractor to cut corners to make it as cheap as he possibly can, right, because he's only going to get paid X amount of dollars. So, but sometimes a flat fee contract will work if you have a good relationship with the person, the contractor. You trust them. Maybe you have a working relationship with them. You've dealt with them on many cases, situations before. Maybe you got another project coming up, and they're going to want to get that. You know, maybe a flat fee does work. If you're kind of adept in construction and you're going to kind of monitor what's going on, then right, you know, flat fee is probably a good idea, depending on the circumstances. Attorney fee provision, in North Carolina, if there is a dispute and you don't have an agreement in your contract with regard to recovery of attorney's fees, then it's very unlikely that the prevailing party will recover attorney's fees at the end of the dispute. Because you have to have a specific statute on point that would allow for that. And if you don't have that in your contract, then there would be no statute that applies either, unless there was something like an unfair and deceptive trade practice situation, but that would have to be some type of fraud that, you know, the contractor engaged in, which mm-hmm. which is rare, happens, but it's rare. So those are a lot of the things that we look at. But mainly, I just want to see, you know, a lot of detail and clarity so there is, in fact, a meeting of the minds. A lot of times what I see, Lockwood, is when there is a dispute, I take a look at the contract at the end of the, you know, when there is a dispute, and it's just really just a mess. Mm-hmm. We can't really tell who, you know, is supposed to pay when, or when the owner is supposed to pay, and what exactly the contractor is supposed to do, and what the detail of the work, or how the costs are properly calculated. And what I mean by that is, you know, maybe the contractor, you know, is including what he is paying his own employees in that cost. And maybe the owner thought that, well, that's not part of your cost. The only part of your cost is what it actually cost your company. Like, what did you pay Lowe's? What did you pay Guy C. Lee? What did right. you pay Seyfert's? You know, what did you pay for these materials? What did you pay subcontractors? Not what you paid your handyman that is you're paying him out of your percentage. Mm-hmm. You know, it just needs to be clarified. I'm not saying that there's a right way or wrong way to do that. It just needs to be clear. There needs to be a meeting of the minds.
We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that's Wes Collins. We're talking about the issue of construction disputes here on Let's Talk Legal. Wes, I've got a few questions, if I could, real quickly, related to the contractual arrangements. And I'm curious about the circumstances associated with subcontractors. And I'm also curious about the issue of liability insurance and things of this nature. But subcontractors, right. And you've got situations where a general contractor will rely on a subcontractor for roofing, for example. And what is the relationship there between the owner and the subcontractor? And is that spelled out in those contracts with a general contractor or in advance? What about those circumstances as well?
Right. So we don't have a contractual relationship with our subcontractor. We have, if we're a property owner, we have a contractual relationship with the general contractor.
Right.
And then the general contractor has a contractual relationship with the subcontractor, the roofer, the plumber, the electrician, whomever it may be. So we're not really telling, you know, the subcontractor, we're not communicating with them because that's the job of the GC. The general contractor is supposed to oversee the work, is ultimately responsible for all of the work. And in almost every construction situation, a GC is going to rely upon multiple subcontractors because they're experts in a particular field, they're licensed in the field, they have insurance in the field, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way, you know, all of that works. Where the rubber really hits the road with regard to the relationship between the owner, the GC, and the first or second or third tier subcontractor, because you can also have situations where you have a subcontractor who hires a subcontractor.
Right.
You can have that sometimes. Where the rubber hits the road is when someone hasn't been paid, and then we get into the lien relationship.
Ooh.
L-I-E-N, the lien, who has the right to file a lien. So basically in North Carolina, the way that works is that the only party that has the right to file the lien, with some exceptions, would be the general contractor. The general contractor, in the event that the general contractor has not been paid, then they have a right to file a lien on the title. And what that is within 120 days of the last work that was done on the property, if someone hasn't been paid or GC hasn't been paid, then they can file a notice of lien indicating that, okay, I haven't been paid this $10,000, and I'm going to file a lien on, it's a notice of lien on your title. And that's a cloud on title, meaning you can't go close out your financing without paying off that lien. It kind of gums up the process of wrapping up the construction.
Mm-hmm.
But if that GC does not file a lawsuit within 180 days of the last day that work was done, then that lien disappears.
Oh.
So it's a 120-180. You have to file the notice of lien, which is just a piece of paper. When I say a piece of paper, there's some details that are required by statute on the piece of paper. But then you have to follow up with a lawsuit before that 180 date, or you don't have the right to do it. And then as far as the subs go, they can file a notice of lien, but their claim is normally through the GC.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is that they can file a lien on funds, okay, but their right to funds is through the relationship with the general contractor. So sometimes you do have situations where you have a subcontractor who hasn't been paid on a job, and they file a lien on the title of the property. But in the event that the general contractor has filed, let's say, a lien waiver and waived all the rights to being further paid, then in many cases that's going to cut off the rights of the subcontractor to file that lien on the title. So, okay. The past 2 minutes, if anyone's listening closely to this, they realize the lien situation is murky. It is. It can get very confusing and complicated. I try to keep things simple, you know, on the radio program here.
Right.
So I think what folks need to learn from that is that if you do have a lien situation, or if there's a subcontractor out there or a GC that has been paid and doesn't know their rights with regard to that, you know, seek out a good attorney to get some particular advice as it relates to the work that was done, when it was done, how much the lien is, you know, the relationship of the parties, that type of thing.
Okay.
Don't take this general, you know, kind of explanation, kind of 10,000 feet above explanation as, oh, that's the way it is, because these are very much fact-driven situations with the rights of parties to liens.
There was one other question, though, related to the issue of subcontractors. And if a subcontractor fails to perform adequately, they don't install the item properly, Who has the responsibility of requiring that subcontractor to come back and either make repairs or to find solutions to those repairs, maybe find another subcontractor? Is that really the responsibility of the homeowner or the general contractor? And how does the homeowner hold all the parties accountable for that?
Right. So that takes us back to our contract.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract is most likely just going to be between the general contractor and between the owner. So we have, if we have a defect in our construction, or we have, you know, something that needs to be corrected, or something that it was, you know, never done, or whatever the problem is with the construction, the relationship there is between the property owner and the general contractor. So the property owner goes to the general contractor and says, "Hey, Mr. General Contractor, my windows are leaking. You know, you need to get your framing guy back in and put my windows in right."
Right.
Or you need to get your, you know, my plumbing is, I got a leak,
mm-hmm.
a leak in my wall. I can see it through my ceiling, or leak in my plumbing. I can see it through my ceiling. And that's the responsibility, would be the general contractor's responsibility to go back and, you know, have that corrected, whether it's through the same subcontractor, whether they hire a different plumber or framer or whatever it may be, it's their responsibility. So that's the, you know, the way that works.
You say that it's the way that works, but, you know, it's interesting out of this, Wes, and again, that's Wes Collins we're talking about, of Harvell and Collins. You've pretty much convinced me. All of this construction programs, and it sounds to me like, quite frankly, all of them, but we'll leave some margin out there, really do require a contract. And for the benefit of both parties, if I understand this correctly, I hadn't considered this, but having it, as we said earlier, documented in a contractual arrangement is beneficial to all parties. I hadn't even considered that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, you don't have to have a written contract.
Yeah, but
it's just highly advisable to
right.
have one.
No.
Because, I mean, that's really... You know, I know that I'm speaking from a perspective of an attorney here, but, you know, I kind of consider myself to be a regular guy, and I always say that everything's fine until it's not.
Right.
And, you know, and I tell my kids that a lot, you know, oh, it's okay, Dad, you know, well, it's, you know, you need to be more careful driving because it's fine until you're not, until it's not, you know, that kind of thing, or whatever it may be. And where the rubber hits the road with the contract is when things are not fine.
Right.
Because we have a conflict, and it may be because something wasn't done right with the construction, someone's not being paid, whatever it may be, might have a problem with our lending, might have a problem with our construction loan, might have a problem with, you know, something happened with the property, the land, where the dwelling is being built that we didn't anticipate. And when those things happen, which, you know, obviously we all try to avoid in our everyday lives, in a construction context, you're always going to come back to the paper. You're going to come back to the relationship of the parties. And in the event you don't have that paper, that contract, then the law then substitutes in what the obligations are, and you potentially get into a he said, she said about what the agreement was. So he said, she said, verbal contracts.
Right.
And getting into these kind of situations with, you know, in a litigation context or a legal dispute context, those get unnecessarily expensive. Because if you have a contract, in many cases, you can cut right through the response or what the parties say the agreement was, because the agreement's right there in writing if it's well written. But in the event you don't have that, then you've got maybe people remembering things differently based on the current circumstances.
And we're talking with Wes Collins here of Harvell and Collins. As we wrap it up, I think this is the two observations. The first observation, Wes, is that in the case of a home, it is normally the largest and most important investment in an individual or a family's life. So anything dealing with that investment, we should respect. And the first line of respect is to assure that whenever we're doing anything in that home, that we look for proper documentation. And I say that in the form of a contract. And so, Wes, you know, you're saving time, money, a great deal of emotional distress if you will just simply take the time, and I say this to the audience, take the time to reach out to an attorney such as Harvell and Collins and seek some advice on your arrangements, your contractual arrangements in the process of construction or any investment in your primary financial and, I would say, cultural investment, your home. That's an important document. And Wes, I appreciate this. I want to remind everyone, Wes Collins, and of course, we're talking with him, but of Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins at Harvell and Collins, the number 252 area code 726-9050 or online at harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Wes, thanks for your time today.
Yes, sir, Lockwood. Good talking with you.